Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, and welcome back to New Books in Psychoanalysis, a podcast on the New Books Network. My name is Jordan Osserman, and I am your loyal host for today, and I'm very excited to be back after a brief hiatus from the program. And I'm also very excited that today we'll be interviewing Dr. Leon Brenner on his recent book, The Autistic Subject on the Threshold of Language, which is hot off the press. It came out in September 2020 with Palgrave in the Palgrave Lacan series. And some of you may have seen this book doing the rounds. I believe Leon spoke to friend of the podcast, Vanessa Sinclair, on her Rendering Unconscious podcast. And there have been interesting discussions about the book on Facebook and YouTube and other places. So I'll just introduce our guest first before we dive in. So Dr. Leon Brenner is a research fellow at the University of Ghent and a lecturer at the International Psychoanalytic University, Berlin. He is a psychoanalyst in formation and a member of the Association for Psychoanalysis and Psychotherapy in Ireland, also known as APPI, L-O-B. I'll let him tell us what that one stands for. I believe it's German. And a founder of Lacanian Affinities Berlin, LALAB is its acronym. And Unconscious Berlin. Dr. Brenner's interests are Lacanian psychoanalysis and French philosophy. So welcome to the program, Leon.
Thank you. I'm very excited.
Yeah, we're really pleased to have you. Just to start us off, it'd be really interesting to hear about your own journey into psychoanalysis before we get into autism in particular, because as we just saw in, the kind of affiliations you have, there's a sort of international medley of kind of organizations that you seem involved in and different kind of areas where you're doing psychoanalytic work. So if you could tell us a bit about that, that would be great.
Okay, yeah, for sure. I think it's quite a regular story. I started from psychoanalysis, starting by reading Freud, being very excited about psychoanalysis and Freud as a teenager, and was dreaming about going to the university and studying psychology, which I did. But at the same time, I also did a degree in philosophy, and somehow I fell in love with the conceptual realm. And started working in philosophy and doing another degree in philosophy. But while working in that field, I was very much attracted to French theory and French political theory, etc. And at some point, I stumbled upon Lacan by accident. Jacques Lacan, this is the psychoanalyst that, let's say, I adhere to his teaching and in some way or another today. And that, again, made me exchange lovers, and I came back into working in psychoanalysis in a more clinically oriented perspective. And today I try to preserve both, in a way. So today my work is I work as a teacher and as a scholar, and I write and do research at the university, but I also have a private practice and develop myself as a psychoanalyst there.
And it seems, from what I've gathered, online that there seems to be something of an emerging Lacanian scene in Berlin that you seem very much a part of. Could you say a little bit about what the Lacanian world is like in Berlin right now?
That's terrific to hear. You know, Berlin was the center of psychoanalysis in the 20th century, beginning of the 20th century. I can't say this is the case today, but we have big aspirations here. It has become a super international city. I work with people from so many places. In terms of the work that, let's say, the groups that I am part of do here, there's a lot of excitement. Also in terms of just taking Lacan's theory and finding some interesting contemporary implementations, and this is usually in the form of arts or, let's say, publications which are not academic. But also, I think there is a certain rise in interest on the clinical side as well. If you ask me, Lacan is fascinating. There is such a heuristic depth to his teaching. And from my students that I meet in the university and outside, it seems that this kind of style and this perspective really kindles a unique kind of desire. For knowledge, that is to learn and to create, but also for unconscious knowledge, which we see by encountering people in the clinic. And let's say the projects that I do today is I participate in two projects, or sort of one of the founders in our group that's called La Lab, that's doing a lot of activities here, like reading groups, academic groups, we have supervision groups, we have our own journal that we publish a few times a year. And also a more artistic project that I take part of that's called Unconscious Berlin, where we try to find a new medium for expressing intricate and important psychoanalytic notions.
So tell us about how you got interested in the subject of autism in particular.
Right. The book was born out of what I can call an acute disparity I identified between two discourses that supposedly address the same object. One can say the scientific discourse and the identity discourse on autism. From the perspective of science, autism is determined as a developmental disorder. This is how it's defined in the DSM-5 as the sort of setback in the development of social and communication skills that manifests in restricted or repetitive patterns of behavior. Now, from this perspective, autism is a knowledge-independent entity in the world that has been affecting humans before we discovered it. So what we see on this side is a slow elaboration of autism using scientific tools. And we see scientists ask questions like, what kind of thing is autism? Is it a psychological, a physiological, a genetic conditions? What behaviors distinguish it from other forms of pathology, etc.? And by asking all these questions, we see scientists attempting to determine autism as an object of science, which is a mental or physical disorder to be objectively studied and eventually contained. Now, on the other side, and this is the side of actually autistic people. So I'm talking about subjective testimonies, and there's so many, and they're so wonderful. I'm really urging the listeners to read some of these books, and we can find them in books, in popular media. I'm a member of several internet forums, which are inspiring. And in all of these formats, we see autistic people describe autism as part of who they are. So this is more like a sense of selfhood, a unique part of their identity, and not as a handicap that should be eradicated.
And this is kind of linked to the rise of the neurodivergence movement, right?
Exactly. So the neurodiversity movement, is let's say, how this discourse penetrated the domain of ethics and politics. And we see a movement that that demands the rights and recognitions of autism as a neurological variant of humanity. And we have a lot of outspoken autistic people, like Temple Grandin, for instance, that go against the notion of a cure for autism. And she says something on the line of, if I could snap my fingers and not be autistic, I would not, because then I wouldn't be me. And she says, autism is part of who I am, right? And this is a certain distinction I very much put an emphasis on in the book, that autism being something that is pervasive, all-encompassing, should be referred as something that someone is and not something that someone has, right? And maybe a good example could be, let's say, type 1 diabetes, which is an illness that affects some people, and it's serious. There's a lot, a lot of cost that one has to pay by having this illness from a young age. You need to take injections and measure your calories and sugars, etc. So this obviously has a dramatic effect on the psychology of a person. But when you talk to people that have diabetes, you would see that many of them say, well, I have diabetes. It does affect me. It does shape some parts of who I am. But it is not all-encompassing. There is part of me that it has nothing to do with diabetes. And autistic people say something different. They say there is no part of me that I can define outside of this autism. And this is, again, why diabetes can be defined as something that someone has, while autism, at least in the scope of my book, is defined as something that someone is, right? So this is the what I call the identity discourse that autistic people adopt, and they describe autism as part of one's identity, and in psychoanalytic terms, we call this the ego. Yeah? Now, in my book, I propose that both the realist scientific discourse and the normative identity discourse in a way fall short of designating the singularity of their object. So they do so by confusing what I call what is subjective about autism. And it's confused with the object of science on the one hand, and with the ego, which is an object by itself on the other hand. And this dual misrecognition is what revealed to me the theoretical vacuum from which this book crawled up, sort of like a place of truth coming out of the well, armed with her whip to chastise mankind. And In this place that was discovered, this is where my main argument unravels. And yeah, this is what is stretched in the book between the unconscious and the place of language, and what Lacan called the subject. Quite paradoxically, because the subject is the object of psychoanalysis.
Yeah, and I mean, I think for some listeners who might have heard something about what psychoanalysis has had to say about autism, the sort of popular picture that's, you know, depicted in the media is not very favorable towards psychoanalysis. So some people may have heard about in France, a documentary that depicted Lacanians and other psychoanalysts in a very bad light around how they treated autism and suggested that they had very retrograde views. But you engage and show the readers how there's actually a lot to gain, and particularly from the French-speaking world, about the work that psychoanalysts have done in the field of autism. So could you correct the picture for us a bit, or tell us a little bit about what some of the misconceptions might be?
Yes, exactly. And this is very important to stress. And I have to say that the history of autism, in a way, here sort of slightly referring to the history of madness when we talk about Foucault, but the history of autism has been a history of misrecognitions and confusions from the beginning. You know, this term was invented by Bleuler in 1910. The term autism, and he used it to actually describe a severe form of schizophrenia, which in entailed a total detachment from reality. And then his followers, these famous psychoanalysts that did engage with the subject of autism, referred to it as childhood psychosis. Right. So here we have exactly these psychoanalysts that I think can be referred to as the ones that have been engaging with the question of their mother. Right. Now you have Margaret Mahler, Bruno Bettelheim, Donald Meltzer, Franz Tustin is a very prominent one. And it's true that the most pressing polemics against the implementation of psychoanalysis in cases of autism emphasizes exactly the fact that psychoanalysts have always blamed the mother. And we have this term called cold mother, which is adopted from this field.
I think refrigerator mother, isn't that the other one?
That's another one. That's true. Yes, yeah. Yes. These terms usually are related to Bruno Bettelheim's book, The Empty Fortress. Now, again, I think it's important to address this issue and to acknowledge that it's true that in the history of psychoanalysis, some have gone on that route and definitely flirted with this idea. But I venture to argue that the theoretical richness of psychoanalytic texts having to do with autism greatly surpasses this notion, especially in the Lacanian field. And just to correct a notion that should be corrected, because you know, psychoanalysts, they talk about the biography of the patient and they discuss the relationship with the parents. So obviously there is something there that is, let's say, a material for an analysis. But even Bettelheim, that you know, they specifically address Bettelheim as the one that is very audacious in referring to the cold mother. But even he said, quite explicitly in the book, he says that it's not the maternal attitude that produces autism, but the child's spontaneous reaction to it. And I think this is important in psychoanalysis, that, and especially in the Lacanian perspective, that the question is the question of the subjective reaction or the spontaneous subjective reaction to certain historical circumstances. But anyway, in the book that I wrote, I present a psychoanalytic framework that does not adhere to this motif in any way, but is rooted in a linguistic approach to psychoanalysis, as is common to work of Lacanian analysts.
So, well, let's go into the theory in a little bit. I just was wondering if you could help sort of flesh out what would it actually mean then for, let's say, the parents of an autistic child to take their child to a psychoanalyst who might be mobilizing some of the ideas that are discussed in your book versus to have a more traditional approach to treating autism. And perhaps these things aren't, you know, they might happen side by side, but what might the differences look like?
Yeah. Well, maybe we can start more generally. Yeah. Because, you know, autism is commonly viewed by practitioners today as a mental illness, yeah? A developmental disorder. And when practitioners talk about mental illness, they usually refer to something, you know, that is a result of, you know, something that went wrong. And autism is described as a developmental disorder, so something went wrong in the process of development. But I think, to me, this is a bit strange, and this might characterize the Lacanian perspective, because I think that when thinking about things from a psychoanalytic perspective, subjectivity itself is something that went wrong. As you know, Freud argued that at a very critical time in a child's life, something of the sexual drive becomes fixated. And this is something that is fixated, let's say, generally in the child's way of being or enjoying the world, that stops its development and from that moment remains frozen in a way. Now, this fixation is not a leap towards health. On the contrary, it gives rise to repetitions in our lives that shape the way we enjoy as adults, but also shapes our suffering, a specific kind of suffering. And in this sense, I mean, every subjectivity is the outcome of a developmental disorder. And what I think Freud generally argued when he said that is that there's no proper way to be in the world, only wrong ways that are fixated at an early age. In this sense, if we follow Woody Allen's imperative, whatever works, you know, like any satisfying relationship, whatever works is whatever keeps on going, even if it went wrong. Yeah, it works. And when we think about addressing subjects in the clinic, then, and autistic subjects as well, we're thinking about creating the conditions that would enable this thing that went wrong to work. Now, this is not singular to autism. This happens in cases of neurosis, of perversion, and psychosis in the clinic. But again, I don't find it useful to describe autism as a developmental disorder because, well, autistic people enjoy and autistic people suffer. And what makes the encounter with autistic people in the clinic to be unique is not so much that this has, let's say, set itself in course at an early stage in their development, but what I think is the specific way language had been congealed, or the access to language has been fixated at an early age, and maybe we can say something remained frozen then. And this is what defines autism as a singular mode of subjectivity. And what we see in the clinic of autism, then, according to the psychoanalytic perspective, is work with language. And the idea that autistic people are not outside of language, and that the way to facilitate their existence and enable them to have more freedom and joy in their life is by facilitating their introduction into a unique mode of access to language, which is open to them, and in fact is in a way limitless.
Mm. Yeah, I was thinking in the acknowledgements, I think, in your book, you mentioned this podcast on Radiolab called Juicervos, which I had a chance to listen to, which is really fascinating. Great kind of hour worth of listening to get a quick introduction. And they discuss the case of a child who the parents eventually realize that their child has autism, that he's not behaving in the way that his peers do, and something seems to be wrong. And he keeps repeating this phrase that they think is the phrase Juicervos, and it doesn't quite make sense to them, and they think it has something to do with juice. And then they realize that he has this sort of obsession with Disney films, and he's been watching certain scenes in these Disney films on repeat. And at a certain moment, he's playing The Little Mermaid, and he rewinds this scene with the villain Ursula, where she's telling the Little Mermaid how the thing that she'll have to sacrifice if she wants to become a human is just her voice. And suddenly the mother realized, oh, this phrase he keeps repeating, Juicervos, it's actually just your voice that comes from the film. And then this sort of like unravels a way in which the parents are able to use sort of Disney films to sort of it seemed to me, you know, kind of an illustration of the point you just made, sort of work with some way in which the child has entered into language to actually begin to have conversations and kind of move things forward.
Yes. Yes, that's absolutely true. And that episode is terrific. I would actually love to work on a Juicervos 2 with Radiolab. Yeah. It's a good idea. That episode got me into the research. It really got me going because at the time, and I think even today, there aren't a lot of convincing theories that would explain this process that Owen, the child in the story, went through, from being completely, almost completely mute, so not using language at all, to a certain moment where his father hides his face, takes a doll, speaks in the voice of Gilbert Gottfried to him, and asks him, "Owen, how are you?" And I think Owen at the time was, I think, at least 8 years old or 6 years old at the time, and haven't been speaking. And his father asks, "Owen, how are you?" in this voice, and he answers, "I'm lonely." Mm. All of a sudden, the silence is broken, and this blew my mind.
Yeah.
And in engaging with this question, this got me working on the book, definitely. Maybe we can talk a little bit about the question of the voice in Lacanian psychoanalysis then.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to turn to that, because that was the funny thing about the podcast as well, is what they didn't dwell on or explore was how it was that particular phrase that he latched onto, the idea of the voice being sacrificed. Mm. Say a bit about that, because I know also an introduction to your book that something Malival, who is, I guess, a sort of collaborator of yours, comments on as well.
Yes. Jean-Claude Malival, he's a terrific scholar from France and a colleague, and he wrote the introduction to the book. And Malival writes that the question of autism is a question of an entry into language. How do autistic children enter into language? For me, it's a question of an entry into language and also the specific mode of access to language, which is enabled by this entry. And maybe we'll try and get there soon. But what we see in autistic babies is that they don't enter into language in a way that we commonly see in, let's say, neurotic babies. That is, through babbling, through this musical aspect of language, through a sort of play of sounds. You know, autistic babies commonly don't speak or make sounds at an early age, definitely not using sounds in order to address their caretakers. There is something about the, let's say, a level of engagement or involvement in language which is lacking in this entry, this mode of entry into language. Now, what I argue in the book, and I'll try and be as sort of general and not really delve into too many, let's say, conceptual elaborations now. What we see in autism is a certain refusal at a very early age to assume on themselves what I call an enunciative role. In other words, there's a certain refusal to invest something of the very immediate vivacity of, let's say, the body in the field of language, or what we call in Lacanian psychoanalysis, the field of signifiers or the big other. So this thing, and maybe this will sound a little bit like a lingo right now, it's what is called a refusal to invest the voice as an object, as a drive object, in the field of the other. So what do I mean exactly by this? The concept of the drive is extremely interesting in Freud. I think it's also interesting for us English speakers because there's a huge translation error in the common translation of Freud, where Freud uses two terms when he talks about the psyche. He uses instinct and Trieb, two German words, and both of them are translated in English to instinct. Whereas instinct is obviously an instinct, but Trieb is a drive. And the drive is a very interesting psychoanalytic notion that we can say is a product of the encounter between the body and language. So the drive is a sort of a psychic representation that entails the mutual effect of language and the body, this effect that they have on each other. And if I state this more simply, I can say that the drive emerges when something of the, what I call the vivacity of the body, is cut out and invested in the big other or in language, what is also the intersubjective domain of culture. Now, in order to understand this, maybe we can use like a simple example of a baby that's being born, and unfortunately babies don't take care of themselves, they rely on their caretaker, and at a certain moment some need of a baby is not answered immediately. If we assume hypothetically that in the womb all needs are met, although this is obviously not true, but hypothetically, when the baby's out in the world, sometimes it will be hungry, but there will be no food in the baby's mouth. And what the baby has to do at that point is address a caretaker to feed him or to take care of him. Now, in order to do so, the baby has to use a language that this caretaker will understand. So in a sense, we say that the baby has to use the language of the other in order for his needs to be met. And when the baby does so, when the baby cries, the cry is the first moment where something of what I call this vivacity of the body, of the need, of the instinctual need, of something that is total and complete all over the body, is circumscribed under a specific signifier, this cry. And this is a reduction. This is a process where something is fixated. Yeah. And what we see here is that something of the body itself is cut out and then translated into language. Now, what Lacan says about this process is that this is the process where the drive is created. In terms of, let's say, feeding, Freud called this the oral drive. Freud also talked about the anal drive. And Lacan adds to the list the scopic drive, the one where we see things, the gaze, and the invocatory drive, which the object of the invocatory drive is the voice. Now, the drive object, because of what I've just said, is situated between the body and language and plays a crucial role in the mediation between the subject and language. And in a way, it defines the way we are invested in the world and the way we desire. Now, each drive has a crucial function. And what Lacan argues that the invocative drive, the one that has to do with the voice, have a very important role in congealing or setting in place the mode of access to language. And what I argue in the book is that what we see in autism is something that has to do with the question of the voice. Mm. What I argue is that there is a particular aspect in the relationship between the body and the other, or the body and language, that is problematic in autism. Now, yeah.
Carry on.
Okay. So I just thought about maybe explaining a little bit about what I mean by the voice, because it's hard to explain what the voice object is in Lacanian psychoanalysis. I can tell you briefly that we cannot reduce the voice to the intonation of speech or the vocality or the meaning that we convey in speaking, or even the materiality of the speaking body, I mean the cavity and movements of the mouth. What I can say, and I'll try and put this simply, is that the voice as a drive object is what carries the subject's presence in speech. It is what makes the subject of enunciation, and it endows speech with an otherness that is irreducible to the message. Now, in the book, I provide an example that I take from the field of semiotics, and specifically from the work of Roman Jakobson. And he talked about the phatic function of language. And the phatic function is a sort of function of communication where we establish a line of communication regardless of the content communicated in this line. So dysfunction materializes when the subject invests itself, or we can say even invests its being in language, and in a more Lacanian term, where something of the body's excitation, and Lacan calls this jouissance, is invested in discourse and makes discourse a place which represents the subject's being. Now I'll try and say what we see in autism. So this initiatory sort of yielding of jouissance to the other in language is a thing that autistic subjects find to be traumatic. So, in other words, making language a place which, let's say, carries the subject's enunciative being is the thing that is problematic for the autistic subject. And it is experienced as extremely distressing, as a mutilation, and even a cataclysm. And this is why autistic subjects, what I call this, retain the voice. They effectively separate themselves from the field of language, from the field of the signifier that threatens them with this, let's say, brutal castration. And what we see in autism, and this is relevant for the podcast Juicervos, we see that the retention of the voice sometimes materializes in states of autistic mutism. And while autistic subjects do gain access to language, they do everything in their capacity to avoid the enunciative presence of the voice, or what Jakobson calls the phatic function. Now, some autistic people use, in order to do so, they use a very monotonic voice. They use a voice that's devoid of effect. Some use very high-pitched voices. And some use dolls, like we saw in the case of Owen, and portraying themselves as someone who is not the enunciator, but someone who speaks through the doll in proxy. And some repeat sentences and words in the exact intonation in order that they first heard them. So all of these are important strategies and attempts to engage in speech in order to convey information, but also to erase the enunciative presence of the subject in speech. And I think that is through this perspective that whatever happened with Owen can be elaborated, let's say, in a more interesting and maybe useful way.
Yeah, I mean, I think absolutely that's what the theoretical elaboration that you offer helps to do, is kind of make sense of, the sort of more commonplace, I guess, psychiatric kind of way of describing autism as a set of behaviors without providing a sort of underlying, you know, sort of theoretical scaffolding, so you can make sense of why would all of these different seemingly unrelated symptoms or behaviors have something in common that gives it the name autism.
Exactly.
But I mean, something I was wondering, and perhaps this is like an impossible question to answer, is so, you know, we know from the Bettelheim quote you provided that that this isn't about the mother, but, you know, potentially a spontaneous reaction to the environment. But why one choice of entry into language versus another? You know, is there any way of postulating why would a child end up having this relationship to the invocatory drive rather than a neurotic one?
Yes, this is another good question. And I have to say that this is where I think a certain modesty that is characteristic sometimes of psychoanalysis needs to be put into place. Psychoanalysis, at least I think, is not a discourse that can answer all the questions in the world. Let's say it's not the discourse of all discourses. It has its advantages, but also its limitations. And at least the perspective that I adopt, and the perspective that I adopt in the book, does not engage so much with the question of causation in these terms. So in the book, I am not so much interested or engaging with why do people become autistic in the first place and how can we change that, for instance. I am more concerned with the fact that autism is there, autism is what somebody is, and how can we help this person have a better life with his autism and be autistic in a way that is useful and fulfilling. So I can't say that I can tell you, but there are a lot of researchers that do engage with that question, mostly in the field of, let's say, brain physiology. And I think there's a lot of research done on that topic today. But this is, again, not a question that I engage with in the book.
Yeah, although one of the things that I was a real light bulb moment for me when reading the book was how you pointed out that lots has been written about the so-called cognitive deficits as well as cognitive advantages that autistic subjects have, such as, sometimes a very impressive memory. But that while the sort of cognitive field might see this as a difference in, innate brain structure, that if we take the approach of thinking about this as how you enter into language, it could make sense that your brain would develop in a certain way because your relationship to language is such that you don't that you need to memorize words rather than necessarily kind of enter the symbolic in a way in which in a more neurotic way, so that you kind of the way in which you enter language has effects on how your brain might actually develop.
Yes, and I think that makes a lot of sense. And this is a major aspect of the book, which comes later. This is sort of, I call this the payoff of the book, is another interesting topic that sort of I engage with, is the exact way in which language is implemented by autistic people in the construction of their reality. So how does it exactly work, and how does that affect the way, how psychologists say the way they behave and the way they perceive other people and themselves. So the focus that I suggest to take when addressing autism is on language. And I'm not inventing the wheel here, because abnormalities in language and speech development are one of the defining features of autism. This is quite acceptable. But what I sort of stress in the book is that we cannot view autistic subjects as exiles from language. There is something that happens, and we talked a little bit about the level of the voice. In the book, I talk a lot about this mechanism that's called foreclosure, a sort of a psychic mechanism that sets the mind in place, let's say, sets the way language becomes the building blocks of a subjective reality. And I argue that this mechanism functions in a specific way in autism, and I try to understand how it actually enables autistic people to use language and to speak. And what I argue in the book, and I offer an interesting theory that I'm developing with, again, my colleague Jean-Claude Maleval from France, is that while autistic subjects are not disposed to signifiers or to the signifier, they do develop a language on the basis of the sign. And this is something that many Lacanians do say about autism, is like a common, something that's commonly accepted, is that in autism, there is no big other. This is one of the accepted phrases you see in Lacanian psychoanalysis of autism. And in the book, I try and explain what this means. So this doesn't mean that there are no others in the world, or that autistic people do not want to have relationships. And this does not mean that autistic people don't have access to language. So what does it mean? It means that they depend on signs and not signifiers. Let's do a quick excursion to the field of semiotics in order to understand a little bit what this means. According to this field of, let's say, linguistic research, in language, there are only differences. There are no positive terms. So let's say there are no concepts or ideas that exist before a linguistic system does. And if we want to describe a linguistic system, we describe it as a set of differences. between sounds that are combined together and cut in different places. And this is a word, you know, like the word cat, like a combined of sounds that are interposed. Now, Lacan was a fan of semiotics. And what he argued is that meaning does not arise from a relationship between a word and an object, what is called a signifier and a signified, but it arises from the differentiation between one signifier and another signifier. So he was very interested on the level of the signifier. And this means that concepts, at least in our neurotic minds, are purely differential. So they're not defined by their positive content. They're defined negatively by their relationship with other terms in the system. And this is how the field of semiotics and how Lacan describes a language that is composed of signifiers. Now, I argued in the book that neurotic, perverse, and psychotic subjects use language in this way. They rely on signifiers. Now, a sign is a different form of a linguistic unit, and this is adopted from the theory of Charles Peirce. A sign is composed of a sensory representative. So this would be a written word, an image, or a sight, or let's say smell, like the smell of smoke. And this sensory representative refers to an object in the world or a concept. And when it does refer to this object, it makes sense to a speaker of a language. So let's say a portrait that depicts Napoleon refers to him, and I see it and I can understand that. Now, a language that is based on signs is different than a language that is based on signifiers. And what I argue is that while autistic people do have a mode of access to language, they do achieve a mode of access to language, this mode of access is based on the logic of the sign. Now, how do we describe a language based of signs? We can describe it as a matrix of rigid relationships between representatives and reference. So you can think of it like a code language. And this code language lacks the dynamic subjective factor that the signifier inserts into language. So a sign in this language is encoded into it and sort of petrifies a relationship to a referent that was acquired under a specific context, which sets the relationship between the representative and the object in place. So if we build a language based on these rigid relationships, we see that different contexts and circumstances can challenge the notion that we establish on its basis. So for instance, if I see a cat, and I am basing myself on a language that is based on signs, and I call it a cat, and I see a specific Persian cat on a rainy day, when I see another cat, maybe even a Persian cat on a sunny day, I will not be able to call it a cat. It would be difficult to code these both these objects under the same representative. And this setback is what makes autistic language different than language that is used by, let's say, neurotic subjects. And it has consequences. And, you know, very, very generally, we can say that this kind of language is usually implemented as a factual language, sort of devoid of effect. It lacks this subjective factor that is more dynamic and dependent on context. It's a language that's unaffected by humor. It's a language that has difficulty in coding general concepts. You know, like it would be easy to code the word lassie because it refers to a specific dog, but the term dog is very difficult to encode in this language. We have Temple Grandin saying in her book, Thinking in Pictures, she says, under the term dog, I collect all of the images of the different dogs that I've seen in my life, and I put them visually under this specific word. She says, this is the only way I can even fathom what a general concept means. And not to mention, you know, terms that are that have no concrete referent in the world, like abstractions. Like imagine coding a word like peace. What is the referent of peace?
Yeah. Mm. You what? Could see why a way of relating to language like that would lead to needing an extraordinary memory.
Exactly. Exactly. And we see many autistic people, which are very talented people, very intelligent people, implement this memory in order to achieve a very rich language, a very rich linguistic capacity and a lot of knowledge about the world. But this knowledge is based on this kind of linguistic operations. Right? This language, while it could be extremely rich, extremely useful, and lead someone to a level of independence, complete independence in the world, is more precarious in comparison to the fluidity and, let's say, associative flexibility that the signifier enables. And what we do in the clinic of autism is being attentive to this mode of access to language, attempting to work with it, rather than taking, let's say, a pedagogical approach and trying to teach autistic children to behave in a specific way.
For the kind of final 10 minutes that we have, I wanted to turn to something that's a personal research interest of mine, and it might be a bit speculative for you. You may not necessarily be able to say much on the subject, but you know, there's been some discussion around there's this Netflix show, Love on the Spectrum, which shows autistic people navigating the world of love and romance and going on dates with one another. And I'm interested in this question of what, if anything, we can say about gender and sexuality sexuation in the Lacanian parlance, what we can say about it in relation to autism. One other thing that kind of comes to mind is there's been a lot of discussion in the UK around young gender questioning or transgender people. And a number of people who've been referred to the clinic in the UK that offers care to young people who are considering changing gender, that they've had a massive increase in referrals from patients who are also diagnosed as autistic. And some people have kind of raised alarm bells about this. Other people say, you know, there's nothing particularly noteworthy about it. But I'm curious if any of this, if you have any thoughts on whether how we understand sexuality and gender have any bearing on whether a subject is autistic or not.
Yeah, this is a very interesting topic, which I am beginning to work on today. I do not engage with the question of sexuality and gender in the book. But maybe I'll try and answer briefly from what I've so far gathered. I've seen this show as well on Netflix. It's definitely heartwarming, but I felt I wasn't very comfortable with it. Because what it seemed to me was an attempt to force a sexual identity or even an understanding of what dating and sex is onto autistic people. So I saw very neurotic people trying to teach autistic people how they should date, how they should enjoy sex, how they should enjoy their partners. And to me, that was quite heartbreaking. Because
it's quite silly, because there are these scenes where it's like both partners that are about to go on a date are being taught these rules of social etiquette. And it's like, well, if neither of them care about the rules, then why do they need to follow them?
Exactly. Exactly. And this is very akin to the, I think, behavioral approach, where, again, and I have to stress this, I think behavioral therapists are good people. They really want to help their patients, but there are points where the behavioral approach, which comes with the solutions that are ready made, is problematic. And in terms of sexuality and expression of sexuality, I think this is a classic example. Yeah. Like you said, why should they enjoy each other's company in this way? And you see how confusing it is and how much it doesn't work for them. So I would think a more interesting show would be exploring what dating is for autistic people, inventing it. It's a huge problem because while us neurotics have all these, let's say, information in culture that we can base our own dating habits on and our own questions about our sexuality, autistic people don't have that knowledge and don't have that knowledge coded in their own language. So there's a hard labor of translation needed to be accomplished here. And also, I think, a little modesty and understanding that we have to treat some people, we have to just be hospitable to their otherness and see how they can manifest what sex is for them.
And do you think, is there anything particular to autistic subjectivity around this question of how one defines one's gender identity in terms of some of these questions about perhaps a higher number of autistic people who identify as transgender?
Yeah, let's say at least Lacanian psychoanalysts, while taking the question of sexuality very seriously, ideas and different ideas and notions of what is called the sexual relationship are always taken with a grain of salt. Lacan is famously known to say that there is no sexual relationship. In a way, there is no actual proper way to explicate what is the relationship between two subjects engaging in sex, let's say. All the ideas about sexuality are failed attempts to say something about the sexual relationship, which does not exist. So, you know, all of us, males or females, or even people that define themselves as non-male, gender neutral, etc., all of these are failed attempts to say something which cannot be spoken. Yeah. But for neurotic people, there is a certain way to put that question to rest and take on yourself a certain role in society which is provided to you from culture. Now, what we see in, let's say, cases of psychosis, and Freud and Lacan talk about the case of Schreber, a famous case from Freud's teaching, and Lacan says there's something interesting. He says that in the case of psychosis, the question of sexuality becomes a bit more diffused. And Schreber has the opportunity to find his own solution there. Lacan talks about something that he defines as a transsexualist enjoyment that Schreber chooses to take on himself and sort of makes it his sort of elegant solution to the question of sexuality. Now, what we see in autism is a mode of access to language which does not have to do with the place of signifiers or what we also call the big other. It is in the big other, in the field of culture, that we find all these wrong answers to the question of sexuality. Now, what I think, or this is sort of my thoughts on it at this point, is that while in psychosis there's a certain diffusion and a larger, stronger freedom to express a unique answer to this question, it is still a question that has to be answered from the place of the other. And we see that in Schreber, because Schreber's solution eventually is to be the wife of God. This is what he chooses. But I think that in the case of autism, there is even a more relaxed approach, because autistic people, they don't depend on the big other. They depend on a completely different construction that is more personal, more idiosyncratic. And in this sense, there's a much larger freedom in choosing their situatedness in whatever the spectrum of sexuality is. And I think this is why we see more autistic people being confident and seeking whatever solution they feel fits them.
Although it's interesting, I mean, on that note, I guess that those solutions aren't going to be will nevertheless have some conversation with or have something to do with what's going on in culture, right? Because you wouldn't really, for example, if you identified as trans, that also does draw on a kind of larger cultural repertoire of what that means.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that they will have relevance in what can be called autistic culture, or this specific way that language is used by autistics. And this is sort of a notion I do develop in the book that's called the synthetic other, sort of a supplementary other that is constructed by autism, by autistic people. I think the question of sexuality will have relevance in this field, and not necessarily be so relevant to, let's say, the creators of this dating show that we saw on Netflix.
Hmm. So just before we go, we always ask, what is it you're working on next?
I'm right now leading a research group in Ghent University of several very talented scholars that work on the psychoanalysis of autism. Everyone has an interesting project to work on. And right now I am working on the notion of the skin and thinking about very early experiences of the body surface and the way that they can be translated in what can be said psychoanalytic terms or even topological terms in order to understand autism better.
Huh. Well, this has been an extremely fascinating conversation. I'm sure it has been for our listeners as well. So, Dr. Brenner, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely my pleasure.